John, when did you first develop an interest in the blues, and what sparked that initial interest?
Well, I suppose 1953 saw my first exposure to the blues, although I had heard blues music back in 1949, although at that time I wasn't aware what it was. To me, it was something very, very unusual, the particular song I heard, and it was Silver Fox Chase from Sonny Terry. In fact, what it had been used for was for a dance piece in which I guess they had just invented blue light so that dancers would wear black costumes with skeletons painted on the front, and all you'd see were the skeletons jigging around. And they were jigging around to Silver Fox Chase. Of course, I was 8 years old at the time, didn't know it was the blues, but felt that it was something very different. But 53 came along, and that was when I heard Big Bill Brunsey for the first time, and just fell in love with the music. Wanted to play and sing it for myself, so nagged my parents into getting me my first guitar. And because I toyed with a banjo, and it didn't quite work. Never has worked for the blues. When I got my first guitar, I rapidly started to learn parrot fashion back in those days, because there was no one to teach you.
Did you start working with any blues artists during the 50s?
Yes, a lot of blues piano players were coming over to England. People like Champion Jack Dupree, Memphis Slim, Roosevelt Sykes. The list goes on and on. And because I was basically the only person around, except for Alex's Corner, we were the only two really playing blues guitar around in England. So not that I was that good, but they very often invited me when they couldn't get Alex to accompany the piano players on guitar, because a lot of these guys were used to acoustic guitar players playing with them.
What a great opportunity for you to get to know these people.
Oh, sure.
And did you, yeah. Would you go on tour with them?
Yes, with Slim and with Champion Jack Dupree. We played many cities right through England in a concert situation as opposed to nightclubs. And I enjoyed it very much. And, of course, it helped me learn so rapidly.
When you were playing with these established artists, were you playing 12-string back then as well?
Yeah. In fact, one of the concerts I did with Jack in 1958 in a place that's sadly now been pulled down in Bradford, Northern England, a place called the Mechanics Institute. Really nice theatre. I was billed a huge great poster outside, "The World's Greatest White 12-string guitar player." And that was because I was probably the only one they could think of that was playing 12-string at that time.
Well, being a 12-string player, I'm sure that Lead Belly had a great effect on your music, your playing. And, of course, you've continued to be a huge Lead Belly fan. I think you were possibly the first person to reintroduce Black Girl on record and a few other Lead Belly tunes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Lead Belly has been very much a part of my life since the 50s. And, of course, now we're in the golden age of the CD. It's so much easier to gather a collection together. I mean, much of Lead Belly's work I have on vinyl anyway, but it's so great to see all the stuff that's coming out on CD. I'm sure there's a lot more out there still to be released, but I'm very happy with what has come out, especially on Folkways. And
did you have a hard time even acquiring a 12-string guitar in England in the 50s?
My first 12-string was made by a cabinet maker who I'd met in 1956, maybe going into 57, a man by the name of Anthony Zamiatis, who, of course, has gone on to become a world-famous guitar maker, luthier, and but he was an exquisite cabinet maker. I mean, not him being exquisite. I mean, his work was exquisite. And he made this my first 12-string guitar much in the same way he would construct a piece of very fine furniture. And it really was an amazing sounding instrument. Sadly, it got stolen the same night as the Sharpsville massacre occurred, actually. We had all gone down to South Africa House in Trafalgar Square to protest. Those were the beginnings of the anti-apartheid movement in England. And I left it standing in a corner while I was busy protesting, and somebody made off with it. That really, really upset me. Tony has built a couple of guitars for me subsequently, but of course he's built stuff, many of Keith Richards' guitars, Eric Clapton's guitars, Ronnie Wood certainly, yeah.
John, the British blues revival that that I guess really got rolling in the late 50s and then became internationally accepted in the early 60s, what were the components that led to that revival in England at that point?
Well, it was a thing that happened more around the London area. And it was very, very odd because many of the students in art colleges scattered around London were very enamored of the music of Big Bill Brunsey and Muddy Waters and many other blues artists. And none of us knew each other at that particular time, but we came together in the seeds of a movement. Let me see here. Eric Clapton, actually, I'd met him a little bit earlier than 1962. I think it was either 59 or 60. I was playing in a folk club in Richmond, which is to the west of London. And he came down to see me. And so he's gone on record as saying that I was, this particular evening prompted him to learn to play guitar.
That's great. Now, you mentioned the movement. Other people, of course, who came out of that movement would be Cyril Davies,
Cyril
Alexis
and Alexis. Yeah, I'd known them as far back as 57, I think it was, may have been 56, when they had a folk club in a pub on Wardour Street, in a room above a pub, actually. And it was called the pub was called the Roundhouse. And the club they ran every Thursday evening was called the Blues and Barrel House. And many of the people who performed there were, like myself, solo acoustic guitar players and singers. People like Rory and Alex McEwen, who were the most fabulous guitar players you've ever heard. They played in that Blind Gary Davis style, I guess they call it the Piedmont blues rag style. They were often up there. Cyril, of course, playing 12 string and playing later on harmonica. Alex playing mandolin and guitar. Bill Collier, Ken Collier's brother, playing washboard. And then, of course, all the visiting American artists would look in there as well, like Big Bill Brunsey and Jack Elliott and Muddy and Otis Spann when they came over initially in 1958. And all the piano players that I mentioned earlier were all up there because it was a good, fun place. Had the bar there and everything, and no microphones or anything, but the acoustics of the room were such that you could be heard, the guitar could be heard, and the voice could be heard. You know.
There's been a few recordings reissued of Cyril Davies and Alexis Corner from the late 50s that show, I guess, a skiffle kind of a band emerging.
Yeah.
Perhaps before the blues band that of course you were part of later. This skiffle thing was pretty unique, I think, to England, wasn't it?
That's right. It was the style kind of was based on the old jug band thing of the 20s. Gus Cannon's Stompers or whatever the name of that band was. And they could include guitars and banjos and mandolins, usually someone playing a washboard. And in most cases where people could not afford to buy an upright bass or a bass guitar, they were very new back then, bass guitars, they'd use a tea chest with a broom handle and the broom handle being able to be tightened or loosened as you would, and attached with a string to the tea chest. So you'd thump away at that string, and depending on which way you were pulling the broom handle, you'd get a note of sorts out of it. And some of them actually became quite musically proficient on this strange-looking instrument. Then, of course, Jesse Fuller came over to England and changed everybody's idea of how it should be done, because he had this, actually, for that time, very sophisticated thing that he called the Fatula, which was, I think it was an old coffin that had been cut apart and actually had several strings on it operated with his toes.
I want to ask you about the first electric blues band that came out of England that you were part of. When was that?
That was 1962. That band had its initial unveiling in March of 1962. And the lineup at that time of the Alex's Corner Blues Incorporated was Alex's Corner on guitar, naturally enough. Cyril Davis on harmonica and vocals. Dick Hextall Smith on saxophone. A guy called Andy Hoogenboom on bass, who was quite soon to be replaced by Jack Bruce. I've no idea whatever happened to Andy Hoogenboom. That was the you know, he was actually quite a good stand-up bass player, but Jack Bruce came along to replace him, and of course we had Charlie Watts on drums, which was a nice plus. That was before the Stones, of course, and it was a rotating roster of singers, which included Mick Jagger, Paul Jones from time to time, who later joined Manfred Mann, myself, and a couple of other odd people, a man who I've never heard of since, a man called Hogsnort Rupert. Maybe it had something to do with his exceptionally large nose, but Hogsnort Rupert. And Art Wood, the older brother of Ronnie Wood.
Really?
So it was quite but I guess I was regarded as the permanent singer in the band at that time, because I was the only one who ever actually got paid. The rest of them did it just, you know, for a pint of beer or for the love of it all.
What happened with the Hoochie Coochie Men? It seems that was probably the first electric blues band outside of maybe Chicago or New York, it seems, you know, going back to 62. And obviously, it just opened the door for so many other musicians and singers in England. Did the band split off in various directions?
Well, what had happened, I'd gone away to Germany for many months during 1962, after the initial debut of the Corner Blues Incorporated. And then when I came back in January of 63, I discovered that Alex and Cyril had, you know, the most almighty row and parted company, and they had formed two bands. So there was the Alex Corner and his Blues Incorporated, and Cyril Davis and his All-Stars. And they both wanted me to join their bands. And rather than show any kind of support for one above the other, I literally joined the Cyril Davis band on the toss of a coin, what we called a half a crown back in those days, 2 shillings and 6pence, which was a big silver coin. And I flipped it up, and I think it was tails for Cyril. And he won, so I started working with Cyril Davis and the All-Stars, which at its initial unveiling had a guy called Bernie Watson on guitar, Ricky Fender on, or Ricky Brown sometimes known as, playing bass, Carlo Little on drums, and the guy who used to do all the Stones piano work, but who sadly died very recently, actually, from cancer, with which he had been living for many, many years, Nick
Nick Hopkins.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was the very first piano player in Cyril's band then.
John, was the Hoochie Coochie Men, was that your first band as a band leader then?
Well, what had happened, Cyril became increasingly ill from the late summer through the fall and winter of 63. And sadly, he passed on exactly a year to when I came back from Germany and joined his band, that being January the 7th, 63. He died on January the 7th, 1964. And what was I going to do? I didn't really want to call the band the Cyril Davis All-Stars anymore. So the name The Rolling Stones had been quite successful for The Rolling Stones, so I thought, why not Long John Baldry and the Hoochie Coochie Men? And I brought a discovery into the band fairly soon, actually, after the starting up of the name Long John Baldry and the Hoochie Coochie Men. And that, of course, was Rod Stewart. I'd found him in West London. And the band actually was the Cyril Davis All-Stars as it was at the time of Cyril's death. And then they became the Hoochie Coochie Men.
Another discovery of yours, of course, is Elton John. And is it true that Elton John took the John part of his name because of you?
Yes. His actual family name, his christened name, is Reginald Kenneth Dwight, which is very very bland, middle-class English kind of naming. Very typical. He had worked with me in the band Bluesology in the years 1966, 1967, and the first quarter of 1968. And then he was going, split the band, but we'd already found a replacement for him in Jimmy Horovitz, the keyboard player who was to follow him. He was going to join up with the Dick, what was his name, the publishing company?
Dick James Music.
Dick James Music. Right. He was going there to pursue a solo career as a piano player and singer in the same vein as Neil Sedaka, who was his big hero at that time. And we were sitting on the plane. I think the date would have been like May the 12th, 1968. But I'm sure that's what it was. Our last date with him was in Edinburgh, Scotland. We traveled back to London on an aeroplane a couple of days before he was due to begin his big new career at Dick James Music. And he said, you know, I can't really be going on a stage and calling myself Reg Dwight. It just doesn't sound right. What can I call myself? Well, at that particular time in the band, we had a very fine saxophone player by the name of Elton Dean, who went on later to form the Soft Machine, which is a fabulous jazz rock group still in existence, as far as I know. Anyway, we combined the name Elton from Elton Dean and John from John Baldry, and Elton John was born on that aeroplane flight. January the 12th, 1968.
John, I know you were very close to Willie Dixon, I presume going back probably to what, the early 60s?
1959 was
really
the first time I met Willie, yeah, when he came over to Europe to tour with Memphis Slim as a double act. And they established a base at the Trois Maillets, the Three Mallets in Paris, where Slim played for many, many years. And, of course, Slim moved to Paris. I'd known Willie from, I'd known Slim from, you know, a couple of years before when he first came to England. So Willie and I became very good friends from that time onwards. And I saw quite a lot of him in England because he would organize all the international concert, blues concert tours for Horst Lippmann and whatever, Gerhard Rau, his associate in Germany. And Lippmann, the Lippmann-Rau concerts were some of the best staged blues things. I mean, blues package tours. They'd have like about 15 artists, you know, all legendary artists, all on the same bill. And great to see them in concert setting with, you know, proper amplification and everything. And for many of us in England, it was our first opportunity to see people like Sonny Boy Williamson, well, of course, Rice Miller, Sonny Boy, John Lee Hooker. Muddy, of course, came back on that trip with Otis again. Sunnyland Slim. The list goes on and on and on, because those tours went on for about 10 years, maybe more. And Willie was their booking agent for them in America. He was their man in Chicago. So Willie would always be over for these shows in one capacity or another. If not playing, he'd be organizing things. So I saw a lot of Willie in the 60s right through to the 70s. And then, of course, when I moved over here, I would all the time bump into Willie in Vancouver or Chicago. We even went to Jamaica together. That was a treat.
I know that you did a lot of Willie Dixon material, Hoochie Coochie Man, another kind of tribute to Willie and Muddy. Mm-hmm. In the latter years of Willie's life, he put together a band called the Willie Dixon Dream Band that you were part of, I guess.
That's right, yes. Oh, there were some wonderful people in that band. We had Mose Allison on piano, Carrie Bell on harmonica, Al Duncan, who has wrote one of the songs on this album, actually.
Too Late Brother.
It's Too Late Brother. It was actually written by Al Duncan. I thought it had been written by Little Walter, but no, it was written by Al Duncan, the drummer. Looks a bit like Buck Clayton, actually. And the bass player, Rob Wasserman, who's having a lot of great success with these albums he puts out of duets with him and other people. I mean, an astounding bass player. And
Cash McCall
on guitar. Dear Cash, you were wonderful. So it really was quite a fabulous band. And sadly, when we went to do the Benson and Hedges Blues Festival in Atlanta in 92, it was shortly after Willie had fallen down steps at his home and he had been hospitalized. Anyway, on my return from Atlanta, I stopped in Los Angeles, at Willie's home in Pasadena. He bought this fabulous home there, I mean, on quite large acreage as well, like a mansion, because he had finally getting the royalties from his songs through and everything. But sadly, Willie was wasting away. He had been ill for some time. And when we were out in his garden, he actually collapsed. And even though he was, had lost weight and was weaker, I mean, he was still over 300 pounds that I had to support. I mean, somehow I found the strength to hold him upright until his wife could get the paramedics along and get him off to hospital. And sadly, he never came out of hospital, later died there. But, you know, it had a long life, very fruitful life, very adventurous life, a lot of fun in his life. I don't think I ever saw Willie without a huge smile on his face. I mean, he made everybody's day.